Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. His website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. You can find him on Twitter at InkResearch. Ted, welcome back to the show.
Jim, thanks for having me back, and thanks for everybody listening in today.
You'd swear that the head of the Fed, Jerome Powell, was Taylor Swift. Everybody hangs on every word. And we're waiting to see what he's going to do with interest rates again.
Well, we had a Fed meeting on Wednesday this week, and he did, you know, we put out a piece in the morning before the latest Fed decision. Would Jerome Powell be controversial or courageous? And we kind of lifted the concept from the old BBC series, Yes Minister, was when Sir Humphrey was once telling a minister, you know, controversial only means you will lose votes, but courageous means you will lose the election. And
oh, I love that show.
Yeah, that was a great show. And I thought, well, you know, you could apply that to Jerome Powell here, because he could have stood pat and not raised rates and been controversial, because everyone was expecting him to raise rates. Or we thought, well, you could be courageous and you can keep on with your inflation fight. You can raise rates. Then you're risking more banking problems. And lo and behold, Jim, on Wednesday, he raised rates. And within hours, you had more regional bank stocks collapsing in terms of their share price. We had there was one Beverly Hills-based bank that lost 50% of their stock value within hours of the Fed's rate decision. So we don't quite know why the Fed is doing this. Have they, you know, we could be charitable and we could say they've miscalculated that, despite the fact that we've just had three bank failures, you know, and four if you want to include Silvergate, which wound down on its own. You know, if you want to cut the Fed some slack and say, well, yes, we can understand it takes you a while to figure this thing out, and you've only had, you know, four banks collapse, and yeah, you know, we can understand it's going to take you a while to, you know, get your head around this. Or maybe there's something else going on, and I don't know. Like, all I know is that they're on a path right now that is very, very risky for the U.S. banking system, and I'm just saying that based off of the volatility in the stock prices. I don't think that's a controversial statement. I mean, when you see big money center banks falling, you know, 2-3% within 24 hours of a Fed decision, you know, it's something is the risk hasn't gone down. That's pretty obvious. So we're in this situation in the U.S. and I do want to underscore this is in the United States. The Canadian banking system is and the Bank of Canada have taken a different approach, and along with, by the way, the Reserve Bank of Australia, they've taken a different approach. They've taken a more Canada and Australia, they're basically, we've done a lot of rate hikes, let's kind of take our time now. And yes, the RBA, the Reserve Bank of Australia, they raised rates this week, but that was after they paused them in April. Bank of Canada, they're on pause. Fed is still full steam ahead in the face of all these banking wobbles, in the face of a debt ceiling crisis. It's a very bizarre, I think it's a very bizarre situation. So the problem, though, the crux of the matter is in the U.S., is that the Fed was the banking regulator, and I hope I'm not putting all your audience to sleep here, and but we'll just zoom through this as fast as we can. But look, the Fed was the banking regulator, and 2 years ago it said we're going to be lower for longer, and so it was basically telling the banks that it regulates, oh, we're not going to raise interest rates. Then fast forward, it looks like there's an inflation problem. And in 2022, they changed course and they said, oh, yeah, actually now we have to like really raise rates really, really fast. And the problem is that banks, a lot of banks cannot change their deposit and liability structures that quickly because they make loans. Loans have many years usually. Yes, some are demand loans and you can change them right away, but not everybody wants to do a demand loan, and banks are in the business of, you know, catering to their customers. That's their business. And and I keep hearing this on Twitter and on the financial media all the time. Oh, well, they should have hedged all their interest rate exposure. Problem is first of all, everybody who puts on a hedge, there has to be someone who's like taking the other side of that hedge. Mm-hmm. And secondly, if the banks were to hedge all their interest rate exposure, they would not make any money. And banks are not in the business of, you know, charity. They have to make a profit, just like any business. So this whole notion that, oh, this is all bad management and it's all just one or two bad apples, that I think is losing credibility by the hour. Problem was is the Fed told banks they weren't going to raise rates. Then they went 180 degrees and they hit the accelerator and they raised rates, and banks were caught off guard. Many banks were stuck, and now we're finding which ones got stuck the most. And so,
well,
yes,
Ted, never in history have we seen bank interest rates go up so fast so soon. Never.
That's the issue, Jim. It's the speed in terms of how it's hurting the banks. You know, time. Banks just need time to adjust. They need time to be able to get loans in at higher interest rates. Then they can move their deposit rates up. It has to be a step-by-step process for banks. And yes, there were some poorly managed banks, and they're the first to go. But Will it stop at just the poorly managed banks, or is this a bigger problem? We're about to find out. This is what is happening in the United States right now, and it is a direct result of the Fed's bungling on managing inflation. This is the crux of the matter. No, the Fed gets up there and says, oh, well, you know, it's just a few bad apples, and, you know, no, this is all spin, okay? And they have their agents and people who make money from contracting with the Fed, you know, saying the same thing and who want to get in the Fed's good books, you know, and the authorities' good books so they can, you know, keep their positions in the pecking order for whatever pecking order they are in. The fact of the matter is, the Fed is at the heart of this problem by its botched handling of monetary policy. And, you know, until they're held accountable for that, they will continue to get away with this poor management. So, you know, that's going to, you know, let's hope that the things do calm down in the U.S. Financial system, that, you know, the interest rates now are seem to be leveling out. The market does not believe the Fed can raise rates anymore, regardless of what the inflation rate does. And we will see. And that could give the banks enough time, if the rates stop going up, then they can start, continuing with this process of adjusting their book to this higher interest rate environment. So that's what they need. Let's hope that's kind of what plays out. Hope is not an investment strategy, but, you know, that is the best case scenario here, I think, is that we've basically seen the extent of the Fed rate hikes, at least for the foreseeable future, and it'll give the banking system a chance to catch its breath. So, you know, that's the positive scenario. There are other scenarios, but in terms of the bullish case, I think that's what you have to be hoping is a scenario that plays out.
Now, again, in Canada, the Bank of Canada has paused on interest rate hikes. And some of the latest research, a friend of the show, Tim Cyclesman Wood, for example, pointed out the velocity of money has been slowing down since November. So he said it's not a money oversupply thing. It's either gougeflation, where companies are just saying it's inflation, we're hiking rates, because he said the availability of immediate cash to people is down. So what is the cause of this inflation? He thinks it's more supply chain, and the supply chains now have been repaired, and goods and services are flowing again. So why is inflation still rampant if these interest rate hikes have worked? Or are they not working because it has nothing to do with money supply, but is corporations taking advantage of the situation?
Okay, so a couple of things to unpack there. First of all, I think the interest rates have helped with the demand side of that inflation pull, right? Where a lot of people got checks from the government, and that boosted demand, and we know that story. Yes, the interest rates have helped that, but they don't help with the supply side at all. If anything, they probably hurt it, because it makes it harder to invest in a plant. You know, your interest rates have gone up. So from that perspective, it's counterproductive. With respect to the idea about, you know, companies gouging, look, you know, I'm sure there's instances where that's happening, and there's also instances where companies are getting squeezed. You know, I think you have to look at it step by step. Yeah. But, you know, I would offer another perspective or possible reason why we're getting inflation. It's called the fiscal theory of inflation, where basically it's governments, by spending so much money from the government side, that they're injecting money in and out of the economy. So, you know, in Canada, for example, we've just had a federal budget that doesn't envision a balance at all. No balanced budget on the horizon. Now, one of the implications of that, if you believe in the fiscal theory of inflation, is that Canada is going to continue to have strong inflation because the government's going to be continuing to supply more money than it takes in terms of taxes, and that's going to be inflationary. So we will see how that plays out, but that is definitely a possible scenario. I think the Canadian economy, the Canadian dollar here, has it weakened, but now it's kind of bouncing back. It doesn't seem to be able to kind of collapse, and I'm not saying that in a good way. I'm just saying for those technical traders who've been looking for a collapse, it hasn't happened. I don't see it, you know, necessarily surging either, particularly with the oil price kind of constrained here. So I think there's a lot of cross currents, and yes, let's keep an eye on what the governments do. And in the U.S., whoa. Talk about, it's more, the interesting thing about Canada, it's a little bit more cut and dry here. We've got a government that's spending a lot of money. We've got a central bank that's on pause. Maybe you can put two and two together and come up with some ideas about what's going to happen. In the United States, you've got a central bank that's pushing the envelope on interest rate hikes. It's not clear that they can, even keep the interest rates where they are because of the financial situation. System is wobbling so hard, they may actually have to cut rates or add more stimulus. We don't know. I'm not predicting that. But the fact of the matter is, that's all murky. Then you've got the debt ceiling crisis, which is delaying the Treasury from reloading its bank account. It's called the Treasury General Account. If and when we assume it will eventually get settled, the debt ceiling issue, when it gets settled, the Treasury is going to have to issue a bunch of bonds. That's going to be negative for U.S. growth initially, because the Treasury is going to suck money out of the economy to put it into the government's coffers. Now, government may turn that money around quickly and put it back into the economy, but that all has to play out. So it's not quite as clear what the path is in the United States because of all these balls in the air, and let's just hope they don't all come tumbling down at the same time. And so far, you know, it's just sort of this banking issue that's a headwind, and it hasn't affected Main Street yet. We're still seeing some decent economic numbers, but if the banking system does continue to struggle, that will eventually show up on Main Street lending. Small and medium-sized businesses will have trouble continuing to expand or even getting financing for their operations. We're not there yet, but we may not be that far away from it either. You know, we're just going to have to see how this plays out and whether the Fed ends up blinking.
We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, let's try to be a little upbeat now. You have three reasons why gold stocks might be a good idea right now.
Right. So our insider indicator on the gold group is still pretty positive, and we put out a piece just at the end of April. It's available on Canadian Insider, the blogs area. It's called "Pricing In the Dog Days of Summer for the Dollar," and upbeat for gold, not so upbeat for the dollar. But basically, three reasons why we think gold is probably, and gold stocks are looking good here. When we did our top mining and crypto report for August, gold stocks dominated, and they were all in the top 10% of our overall market rankings. Gold stocks are looking pretty strong on our metrics. And why might that be? Well, we just talked about one aspect in the previous segment, and that is the Fed looks like it's really constrained in terms of how much more it can raise rates because of the banks. So that's the first reason. The other reason, of course, is the risk around the debt ceiling, which we also hit upon. You know, until that gets resolved, there's going to have to be some players globally hedging their bets in terms of the U.S. dollar and U.S. assets. So as that plays out, gold should get some support. And we were talking about that with some of the skeptics on gold back when it was, just 10 days ago, it was testing the support around 1975. And our view was, look, there's just not going to be the impetus to sell gold here while this debt ceiling issue is percolating. Now, we didn't put this in the article, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, if they do get a resolution, multi-year resolution on the debt ceiling, or more than like just a few months, you could see a strengthening of the U.S. dollar just as the Treasury encourages dollars to come in to its bond auctions. But we're not there yet. And the bigger, longer-term tailwind for gold, though, is the loss of market share of the dollar in official reserves among central banks. And we put the chart from the Bank of International Settlements, which basically just shows you that the dollar's been steadily losing its market share. And I know the dollar bulls will say, oh, but the absolute value of the dollar is still going up or holding its own, or there's a bunch of charts flying around. But the fact of the matter is, we look at the marginal buyer or the seller setting the price, and we just think that right now there's sellers of the dollar are more motivated than the buyers of the dollar, and that should keep the dollar contained and at least until the debt ceiling is solved, and it should help gold price. And so far, that's been working out, and it hasn't taken out its all-time high on a closing basis yet. We'll see if it can over the next few days, but in general, things are looking pretty good from our perspective on gold and precious metals and gold and precious metal stocks.
Is Bitcoin going to join the precious metals parade?
Well, that's a good question. The Bitcoin and other crypto, I mean, like it or not, they've been tied to the hip to the NASDAQ for so long. But there's some indications that that's breaking up down that correlation, at least for Bitcoin. And what's interesting is that the expected halving of Bitcoin is less than a year away. The indications are Bitcoin will the algorithm will have the rewards for Bitcoin miners in April. So basically, the way you can look at it, that miners will have to work twice as hard to get the same amount of Bitcoin rewards as they are right now. That's deflationary for Bitcoin. Usually that helps to support the Bitcoin price and push it up. And, you know, combine that with the other factors that Bitcoin enthusiasts, you know, the true believers in it, you know, like to think that it was designed for, and that is to guard, you know, as an alternative to the, kind of fiat financial system, issues. You know, I mean, we have fiat financial system issues in the U.S. right now, so that should also, in theory, be supportive of Bitcoin. But the question is, you know, is it really seen that way by the majority of the holders, or did they, are we still stuck with a lot of crypto holders who just bought it in that whole sort of run up in 2021 and are looking to sell? I think that jury is still out. You know, as I mean, I'm all in on the original concept behind Bitcoin. I'm not saying I'm all in on Bitcoin. I'm saying I'm all in on the original concept behind it. So it would be nice to see it kind of break away from its high, you know, its correlation the past year or two with NASDAQ. You know, look, if you want to buy a high tech stock, there's plenty in the U.S. to buy. You don't need crypto to do it, right? Like the sooner it can divorce itself from the QQQ, you know, it's the tech ETF, the NASDAQ ETF in the US, and those tech stocks, you know, the better I think it will be in the long run for the cryptocurrency space. So now's a chance. We'll see if it can seize that moment and see if Bitcoin can take advantage of the upcoming halving and the headwinds facing the U.S. financial sector.
Isn't President Biden proposing a 30% tax on Bitcoin mining energy?
I think he could propose any tax he wants, but the Congress will have to pass it. So, where the real headwinds are from Washington are the regulatory side, where they've gone sort of full blast trying to increase the cost of individuals using Bitcoin and companies working with it. So they've been very, I think, you know, they've been as aggressive as, well, I shouldn't say as they possibly can, but they've been aggressive on the regulatory side to try and dampen the demand for Bitcoin. And I think that's probably their preferred and most accessible tool. And taxation, I just don't see any. I'll be surprised if they can get any tax measures through the current Congress.
Now, getting back to the banking system in the U.S., deposits are guaranteed up to $250,000. In Canada, it's only $100,000. Does Canada need to up the guarantee for deposits? Because an investment friend of mine said he had a client who recently came into a lot of money and was scrambling to find bank accounts so that he could spread it all out so it would be guaranteed.
Right. I mean, I think it should be reviewed. I'm not in favor of blanket deposit guarantees for two reasons. The biggest reason being, as soon as you do that, you basically give the banks, you know, it's a moral hazard issue. They can basically go up the risk curve on their strategies, and then the taxpayer is faced with having to basically bail them out if something goes wrong. So you're privatizing the gains and socializing the losses. That's not a good policy at all. And secondly, you know, it does encourage people to think about what bank they're using, but I don't think that's the main driver, because I don't think it's reasonable for the average citizen to have to do credit analysis on their banks. But I think, you know, primarily it's you don't want to have the guarantee that you're going to socialize the bank's losses. I don't think that's a good idea.
Anything else, Ted, we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, there's a lot going on, and we've talked about the precious metals. And we've talked in the past about the electric metals issue. I think one of the most interesting developments right now is the natural gas. It's, who knows, Jim, how low the price of natural gas is going to go. I wouldn't want to try and even speculate. But we're getting it to the point where it seems to be getting pretty interesting here. You know, I mean, we wrote about a company today, and it'll be in our Discord on probably on Friday or over on the weekend. But you know, it's a natural gas company in BC. Sorry, Alberta. They're in Alberta. They're not in BC, but they're in the Montney in Alberta. And you know, obviously their revenues have been hit by the lower price. But you know, they've got this carbon capture business that basically the stock price is not assigning any value to. And so if you believe in sort of in the future for carbon capture, and you believe we're kind of near the closer to the bottom than we are the top in natural gas, there's a few opportunities in the space. I'm not recommending any stock. I'm not pointing to this one particular stock, but there are others in the Canadian natural gas space that are pretty cheap. But you know, look, when will the natural gas price bottom? I don't know. Is it now? Is it in September? Is it a year from now? Could be any of those. It could be 2 years from now, 3 years from now. I don't know. But it's interesting what's going on in that space, and certainly it's one that I'm keeping my eye on, and starting to get very interesting.
Ted, always fascinating to chat with you, and thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca. Find him online at CanadianInsider.com or on Twitter at InkResearch. If you have any questions for Ted or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Find us on Twitter at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.